Welcome to the CTO Podcast, an I Hear Everything production. This podcast is dedicated to exploring the challenges and opportunities facing today's chief technology officers. Looking to discover what it takes to succeed as a CTO? Then sit back and relax as we explore the fascinating evolution of the world of technology leadership. Here's the host of the CTO Podcast, the founder of 7 CTOs, Etienne De Bruin.
Yesterday, Rob and I talked about the role of DevOps in building startups. Today, we're going to continue our conversation and discuss how CTOs should rely on automation infrastructure. Okay, here's my conversation with Rob Hirschfeld, the CEO and founder at RackN. Rob, welcome back.
Ken, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yesterday was so great, we decided to do it again.
I'm looking forward to it. Great questions to yesterday, and I know we're going to take it to another level this time.
Yeah, as we mostly have CTOs and tech CEOs listening to this podcast, and talk a little bit about how CTOs can leverage or how they should be using automation in, I'm assuming, in their infrastructure.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because I think we do people a disservice by drumbeating automate, automate. And which is good because people should be automating as much as they can, but we don't give them a lot of ground rules or benefits or even KPIs that they can use to start to understand if they're automating well. Like, we've been working on building a list of KPIs for people to look at, and there's a lot of different ways to do KPIs. I'm looking for KPIs that you can measure by gut reaction in a meeting. It's part of a door. Statistics are awesome and people should be implementing them. But there's an element to my favorite KPI, which is your automation half-life. If you walk into a meeting and people are like, hey, we've got all this stuff automated, that's great. And you're like, okay, when was the last time you changed the automation? People are like, last week or so. And you're like, okay, how long could that automation go without you tinkering with it and you still trust it? That's your automation half-life. And so if somebody's, I can go, this is perfect, it's going to last forever. They're not telling the truth. Everything changes. But if they're like, I'd be nervous in a week, then you've got a real challenge with how you're building your automation, right? Or your environment's really challenging and you need to have defenses against that. If people are talking about, I could go a month or a quarter, you get to a quarter of with half-life for automation. And actually that's really, for most organizations, that would be a godsend. That would mean that their ops people and their DevOps engineers are not toiling maintaining scripts that they've already written. If it's short, that means DevOps and engineers showing up and they're like, I'm always turning the knobs and fixing this because the automation breaks all the time. And the reason I bring that up, and it's my favorite KPI here, is because if you have automation in your organization that's supposed to be eliminating human interactions and speeding your processes, but somebody's always managing it and tweaking it and changing it, then you don't have a very scalable process. And then the way most people build automation, they end up with copies of the same thing over and over again. So you might have 100 copies or 10 copies of the same scripts or very similar scripts. And if one's breaking and somebody's making changes 10 times over in each one of those copies, if you even know it exists, Terraform sprawl or Ansible sprawl, we see this all over the place. And that half-life adds up really quickly when you start to see organizations with tens or hundreds of these scripts laying around.
Yeah, I often talk to CTOs who are automation hungry. Yeah. And it's before it has been manually tested or manually exhausted, the automation thinking is already in play. And my concern with automation, especially when there are dependencies and asynchronous messaging going on, is that we just, as humans, cannot possibly imagine all the different outcomes that could actually take place.
Yeah, that's very true. And this is one of the things you hear about for companies that have climbed the automation curve a bit. They start talking about complexity and systems complexity. And we hear that a lot, especially the work we do around bare metal infrastructure and pieces like that. There's a lot of moving parts to get to build a data center from scratch that you have to get right. And we definitely see people looking at all that stuff and being like, wow, it's so complex. What should I do? we see companies try to address the complexity problem by thinking that the opposite of complexity is simplicity. And they get into sort of a spiral where they're like, I'm going to solve my complexity problem by streamlining these processes to just do one thing, or buy one type of server, or use one cloud, or that the answer here is to just eliminate all the variability in their systems and focus in on one. And there is an element of helpful that can help you, but it actually isn't the way that you manage complexity. Because even if you only pick one thing, you're going to find versions creep in, changes creep in. There's things that you have to keep in mind. The antidote for complexity is really exercise. And it's worth explaining what I mean by that. If you have something, a lot of times when people see something that's really complex, it looks complex because they don't understand it. It's because they haven't been trained on it. You think about a plane cockpit. The pilot flies that plane every day and they train on it. They know what those knobs do. The cockpit is not a complex interface for them. It's a useful interface because they're used to it. You walk into the cockpit and you haven't seen it. It's, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed by all this stuff. The same thing is true with any of these IT systems we deal with. There is an element to the more that we exercise ourselves, but also exercise the automation and make it run and use it, then the more resilient that is going to be. And that's actually part of the complexity theory for systems. There's a lot of times when systems that look complex are actually much more resilient because they have a lot of safeguards and checks and balances. You know, a one button airplane cockpit is not resilient because you can't handle an emergency. You might not push those buttons very often, but you might need them sometimes. The automation is the same thing. When you look at automation and it seems, oh, this automation does a whole bunch of stuff that I don't care about, our natural inclination is to take scissors and then start cutting out all that what we think of as extraneous code. Somebody put that code in there for a reason.
And I think what is genius about what I'm hearing is that simplification of the automation is really just the human being's feeble attempt to try and understand what the F is going on.
Exactly right. That's exactly. And I fall for the same thing. It's, I don't understand what this script is doing. I'm in a rush. I'll just cut out the sections I don't think are needed. And now usually you have two scripts and you aren't able to keep using. And this is the other piece of it. And if you go back to yesterday's episode, when we talked about my origin story with Dell and we created 10 copies of systems instead of one, you know, think of how much more powerful it is. If you can go back and be like, I left all this code in to the script I was using because I got it from somebody else. My buddy gave me this script. If you leave all that stuff in and you add in pieces, you can share it back to your buddy. Mm. You can keep using it. If they fix it, they could give it back to you and you can be like, oh, thank you. Now I can keep using it. And that's the fun thing about exercise that is so powerful is that if you can get into a place where your exercise is collaborative, right? You don't have to be the one doing all the exercise. If you have a company with 10 teams and every team is using the same scripts, then you have 10 people exercising that code and you're not reliant on yourself. Then now we're back to Half-Life.
Got it.
So my Half-Life suddenly gets longer. Even if I'm not using the script every week, somebody might be. And so we're all jointly maintaining it.
Wow.
And so that's a totally different way to think about it.
And so that script is getting exercised because it's being run more frequently, which would imply that issues will surface quickly or edge cases will be addressed sooner.
Exactly right.
I really love that. Now let's talk about, this is very interesting. So let's talk about the startup that has a CI/CD pipeline, super proud of it. There's just a ton of, let's call it SSL certificates and subdomains and all kinds of things that get created, and it's automated. And I think the challenge with these automated scripts is that as there is employee churn or as these things run super duper efficiently and perhaps the exercising turns into sort of lazy strolling or super slow rides on the Peloton, what could a team do? Is it getting together every week or every month and doing the dreaded, oh, let's review all the scripts? Or how does one keep those scripts or the automation alive with people? How do you do the exercising?
Oh my goodness. There's two things that come to mind that are really important for that. One of them is for the types of things you're describing, like a certificate or a key or something like that, build in rotation. So one of the things that makes that more effective from an exercise perspective, it's just if you were doing exercise yourself, what you might be doing here is you're going to look at it and you're going to be like, I'm only doing bicep curls or I'm only doing push-ups, right? If the only thing you do is the same exercise over and over again without some variation, then you are not actually building a healthy exercise routine. And so part of what people need to do as they look at that is that if I'm building a CI/CD pipeline that has these components in it, I want to make sure that I'm not relying on people to synchronize, that I'm actually building some rotate. The script should rotate by themselves. There should be abstractions built throughout. What we do from a rack end perspective is we build what we call an infrastructure pipeline, which is this a series of workflows chained together. And inside the pipeline, there are known extension points. And so part of the other way we do this is if you are building that process, you really need to have very clear points where you're injecting the variations between those scripts or between those teams. And the stronger you make those injection points, then the easier it's going to be to maintain it.
That sounds interesting. Can you maybe just dig a little bit on that? So the rotation, just say that again.
Sure. So in the process, what the danger that people get into is they write a script and then people don't know where they're allowed to play in it. I would think about it.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is very clearly demark the places where you expect people to inject those changes. And that might require a little bit more lift because you might have to build an abstraction or an interface point. It could be as simple as putting comments in there that say, mark in here or something like that. So it's very clear what the delineation is.
I love how you were going to say echo.
You can tell what type of scripting I do.
I can tell. So basically you're inviting teams to modify the scripts.
Yes, you have to. And this is the other piece of advice with this. So that's a technical answer, right? Where you're building technology that has very clear interaction points, right? Because our goal is to have the script exercised or the automation exercised. The only way you can do that is if everybody can use the same automation but not everybody can use identical stuff. So they're going to be making adjustments. You have to give people places to add in their unique need without breaking the whole automation. The other one is human. We have a tendency, without really strong leadership, to run at 110%. And teams get very focused, and I have a lot of open source experience for this, and this is a classic anti-pattern that you see with open source. You get very focused on doing your thing, and you're worried about running, I don't have enough time, I need to get my stuff done, and you run systems at 100, you run yourself, you run your team at 100%. If you do that, you don't have time for the collaboration that you get from sharing this code. So it's just like in life, exercising takes time. If you're going to collaborate with other people to get the benefit of sharing this knowledge, you have to come back and take time. When they make a change to a script, you have to go and look at it and say, oh, let me review that. Let me test it. Let me put it into my system. Let me absorb that, so that we get the benefit of the exercise. What happens if you're not careful and if you've become too busy to collaborate, is that when other people work on the stuff that you produced, hoping to collaborate with you, it's too much of a risk for you to actually take their changes and pull it back into your system and incorporate it. And when that happens, where we are most of the time for most people is that they don't actually get to come back into collaboration. Somebody makes a copy, they keep making changes to it, you never bring it back into your system. The only way that works is that if you've budgeted time to keep up with other people's work.
I think that is so brilliant because it speaks to probably the behavior that, hey, if it is automated, it is more efficient, which means that I have more time to go from 110% to 115% my utilization, and therefore the maintenance of the scripts, or the, like you said, the announcement that something has changed, or the discipline of coming back to these methodologies or whatever someone wants to do, that just goes away, and it just becomes something that no one wants to do. It reminds me of SOPs and playbooks, right? You have this dreaded 1970s idea of industrial America where it's like there's an SOP for doing things and it's been printed on 50,000 handbooks and there's no way you can change it without a 50-step requisition process or whatever. And a good friend of mine, I think it's in one of those checklist books, encouraged people to, hey, every time you execute the checklist, you are encouraged. It's in a Google Doc. Like, you can update the Google Doc. You can change it. You can notice something and then optimize it and just make a little note of what you did. And he actually played a game with his startup where he said, every time you execute a checklist, to find one optimization in that checklist. And so he was having these self-optimizing checklists. And while that's different for infrastructure, where you want to have predictability and to some degree immutability, I can see where if you just think that those Terraform scripts are cast in gold and should never be touched, that over time, without that exercise, it just becomes a dreadful part of the pipeline.
Yeah. And then once you finally get to a point where you have to change it, it's
impossible.
You're like, it's all days. There's an interesting story, because when we were building our cloud capabilities, we built these pipelines that were for bare metal, and they did a ton of stuff. It was amazing how much individual BIOS, RAID, firmware, network discovery, like tons of stuff in those pipelines. And so I was going and I was adapting the pipelines to cloud. And I sat down, I did exactly what I shouldn't do, which is I took the bare metal pipeline and I started ripping stuff out to get just the pieces I need for a cloud pipeline. And I built a whole new pipeline for cloud. And our CTO, Greg Althaus, comes back to me, and it's a good thing I was remote, because he would have smacked me on the head. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm building a cloud pipeline. And he's like, there is no cloud pipeline. I'm like, no, there is. I just built it. He's like, there is a infrastructure pipeline. It needs to work for cloud and metal and VMs. There's one pipeline, right? Wow. This is the discipline. It's incredible. But this is where leadership and discipline come in. I'm the CEO and I'm the one not getting it. It was such a powerful thing for me when he was like, it's no. And I'm like, but it doesn't work in the cloud, because we don't need BIOS. We don't need firmware. We don't need network discovery. We don't need any of this stuff. Mm. And he said, those are bugs. He said, file bugs and we will fix the fact that the BIOS is not working in the cloud. Now, it won't do anything in the cloud, because it needs to be smart enough to skip it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But then we have one pipeline, and that pipeline gets exercised everywhere.
That is something I've heard a good friend of mine talk about as well, is to truly craft. You're crafting. You're not post-haste scripting and that was a case for, again, my friend Aaron is a case for, hey, DevOps isn't really a separate function to what the software engineers are doing. It really is one thing. We're all crafting the creation of code and then the meaningfulness of that code, which is when it is alive and doing its thing.
And this to me is the DevOps craft. In some cases, we think that automation isn't software. We give it a pass. And what we're describing here is actually treating automation with software disciplines. Because, right, DevOps shouldn't just be like, oh, it's ops stuff, do your ops scripts. We should be like, no, we expect reuse and dry code, and we expect Git and immutable artifacts and test behaviors and a dev test prod process for our automation too. Those methodologies, that's to me what infrastructure as code really means. It's not, can I use Terraform and YAML? It's, can I use development processes in building my infrastructure automate, right? And that's to me how it means. And so all of the things we're talking about are fundamentally, you know, what a developer mindset, if you bring it into an ops and infrastructure space, That's what that looks like.
And then with that paradigm, it makes total sense because those are all things that apply to just good, plain software development, the exercise, the extensibility, the entry points, the documentation, the echo statements. All of that stuff applies to code.
That's what's so funny here is that we're acting as if for automation, those are like, oh, wow, that. But if you were developing without that stuff, you'd be like, what planet did I land back on? And, hello, we're in 1980s. I want my modern compilers back. We just haven't, for a lot of good reasons, we're in the infrastructure space. It's hard. And infrastructure is, you're controlling infrastructure. It's what it is. But we have to do better because we can't have operators and operations custom and not sharing code, not collaborating, and not getting the benefits of shared exercise. We need to do better if we're going to keep up.
Yeah, but you just as a final point, you do have the cloud providers seem to be incentivized in the other direction, which is we just want to be the black box in the sky that you can just push things to and everything will work. You have all these primitives, but that seems like these primitives are begetting like the lambdas and the serverless. Hey, just write your code and just have it be in space.
There's definitely an opportunity with cloud to be all in on a platform. Totally agree with that. And there's some great development processes for that. What we're working to do, literally, this is part of Rackham's mission, is to make it so that, you know, you can use a platform. None of those platforms require cloud. You can do containerized platforms and lambdas and all the other infrastructure yourself. We just haven't made it easy enough. The expertise hasn't been codified enough. And so I think that people, I totally agree with you. Developers should be moving up stack into better abstractions and into platforms that carry value for them. And there's times when they go up stack into lambdas where it's helpful, but that you, at some point with your lambdas, you might be like, you know what? These three lambdas are always calling each other in this sequence. It would be simpler if I just put them into one routine. And so there's de-lambdification as you grow and scale too.
You're also decoupling for me right now this idea that you don't have to do AWS Lambda or Google functions. You can just bare metal it, or you can OpenStack. I remember when Rackspace announced it back in the day.
A long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long time. That was when we had our first managed, when I was CTO of that company. Man, I was so proud and excited when we had our first issued managed server and I could just do that little SSH and just get that prompt. And just to visualize that this is my little rack inside of this massive data center in San Antonio. But I think to some degree, this generation of founders are just assuming that things have to be paid for at this micro cent level and utilization. When why can't you just spin up a few one-use servers and just have your own little cloud inside of it? This is what you're talking about, right?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Making the type of, and one of the reasons why we can't easily is because we've not made it where it's easy to share and learn from each other, and everybody has to do all the work themselves, all from scratch.
Is this the idea behind an open stack where if someone implements a serverless concept that is of, like, the, are there primitives being released inside of OpenStack as well?
Not within OpenStack, and I haven't been as tied into the community for a long, long time now. But I think some of that is coming out of Kubernetes, and do that with the operator frameworks, do that with the ecosystem around Kubernetes. But the idea here is that it comes back to sharing and reusing code. What you want to be able to do is follow in somebody else's footprints. And if you find issues and bugs, we need to make it so it's easy for them, you to share back to them. And there is a degree of open source thinking in that. It really just ends up being collaborative thinking from that perspective. And we don't have to put a license or an open source label. It's really just people working together better and taking the time to help each other. But there's nothing. The clouds are super powerful. They really let you advance quickly. And for somebody who's starting out, it's fantastic. But yeah, it is helpful to decouple the idea. Really, it's a software delivery model. And it wouldn't be possible to run software yourself. That's what we help customers do fundamentally. So I know it's possible because I see people doing it. I think helping people scale those things, that's part of it.
And most notably, of course, DHH with his rants on moving Basecamp out of the cloud and all that.
He's done a lot to get people scratching their head on what you actually need and what it costs. And I'll tell you, especially with the amount of AI ML and the new training model, like people are asking questions because they know they're going to be consuming a lot more compute. In this case, servers are cheap. It's not, and this is the mythology that the cloud providers have created. They do get discounts on hardware because they build and design their own. They have a whole bunch of engineers, so there's hidden costs for that. But at the end of the day, they're not really getting a magical super price on hardware compared to what you could buy from Dell or HP, Lenovo, whoever. There's plenty of people.
Yeah.
The difference they have is the expertise they've brought into those systems and how and what their patterns are. But if you're just doing a couple servers, it doesn't require that much expertise. You can actually do that work.
Yes, but then now you have with LLMs and stuff, you have Azure sort of baking in all these things you inherit for free, at least initially. So I can see how all this compute power that's going to be needed for the training your own models and all that is a disincentive to really try your hand at bare metal or something like that. What do you think?
Oh boy, the trend lines that I see go in the other direction, but that's our bread and butter. What I see, and I've done some speaking about this using what I call generative DevOps. This is probably a whole nother
generative DevOps. What? Why are we talking about this? That sounds fascinating.
Show number three.
Jeez.
The generative DevOps stuff is making it possible for you to take the expertise that you need to do this work and not be worried about, oh, I don't know how to do set up a bare metal server. Oh, wait a minute, I can ask ChatGPT to walk me through the process. What should I buy? How should I set things up? And it's not quite there yet. And this is where I see companies like Reka and being able to do these follow-on pieces and add in that specialized expertise so that you don't get hallucinations about whether or not your firewall is set up correctly.
Yeah.
But the idea that I can tap into this expertise to do this work and literally be like, oh, I'm trying to figure this out. How do I do this? It's a game changer in how those things get built, how you can look at that, because all of a sudden we've brought expertise into everybody's day-to-day that they didn't have access to before, or they couldn't get in context. And so it's a very different thing when you can say, hey, ChatGPT, I have this type of hardware and this type of switch and this type of OS, and I'm trying to do this. What should I do? And it will give you a pretty good list of options and things to consider. And if you then ask it to walk you through the process, it'll do a pretty good job of walking you through the process. All of a sudden, DHH is not as crazy anymore, right? Because you could be like, I'm going to buy 10 servers and I'm going to set up my own data center.
Yeah, tell me what to do.
And so we have this very interesting place where, and I think this pattern goes to a lot of different industries, but for us, all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait a second, I now can actually consider, I have access to the expertise that before required you to be an Amazon or a Microsoft.
That's
or
amazing.
And lock them up.
That is amazing. Wow, that was amazing, Rob. I really enjoyed this chat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that wraps up this episode of the CTO Podcast. Thanks to Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and founder at RackN, for joining us. If you would like to contact Rob, you can find a link to his LinkedIn profile in our show notes. You can contact him on Twitter, where his handle is Zehicle, Zehicle, or visit his company website at RackN.com. Just one link in our show notes I want to tell you about. If you didn't have a chance to take notes while listening to this podcast, head over to CTOpod.com. where we have summaries of all our episodes and contact information for our guests. And if you want to share your stories of technical strategy and leadership in the C-suite, you can apply to be a guest speaker on the CTO Podcast. Of course, you can always reach out on social media. Our handle is at 7CTOS on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can contact me directly. My handle is at etdebruin, E-T-D-E-B-R-U-I-N. If you haven't subscribed yet and want a steady stream of CTO brilliance in your podcast feed, we're publishing multiple episodes each week. So hit that subscribe button in your podcast app and we'll be back in your feed tomorrow. Okay, that's all for today. But until next time, remember that if things aren't breaking, your company isn't growing.